Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, heat advisories are increasingly in the forecast, as we just heard, but what exactly does that mean? We talked to a physician and a psychologist about how extreme heat impacts body and mind. Later in the program, why you might want to let that liquor cart pass you by on your next flight. But first, we are in full summertime mode here on the First Coast. Nobody needs to point out that it is hot, but the hazards of extreme heat are worth talking about and guarding against. To discuss that, we welcome Dr. Sunil Joshi, Chief Medical Officer with the City of Jacksonville. Good morning, Dr. Joshi.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And Dr. Christine Caulfield, psychologist and CEO at LSF Health Systems. Good morning, Dr. Caulfield.
Good morning.
Welcome
Great
back.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Joshi, you are part of the city's excessive heat task force, which has unveiled a number of programs to help beat the heat. Before we get into the specifics of that, though, how is extreme heat different from just being uncomfortably hot?
Yeah. So, I mean, extreme heat is when we know is that at those temperatures in particular with heat indexes where we're more likely to see heat-related illnesses as opposed to just being hot outside. And so that's why those numbers in particular, 108 degrees to 112 degrees or even 113 degrees with a heat index, are the numbers we've chose to do some of these cooling projects and cooling centers, is because those are the numbers that typically are associated with heat-related illnesses, whether it's heat cramps, heat exhaustion, or even heat stroke.
And so describe for us a little bit of the physiology of what's happening when we start to get into those extreme temperatures.
Yeah, so as we get into those extreme temperatures, in particular, if you're exerting yourself outdoors, you can lose water and bodily fluids very, very quickly. And so we worry about the water being lost, but also the electrolytes being lost as well. And so when that happens, that's when we start getting these illnesses, whether it's a heat cramp or you just get like muscle aches and pains, where you do need to rehydrate at that point. And you hear a lot about that with football players and soccer players that are playing outside in the heat. Or you get to heat exhaustion, which is now that point where you're starting to teeter towards heat stroke, where you're not only tired and fatigued, you're also getting nauseated, you may be vomiting, you're losing more fluids, and you may start to get headaches and have an increased body temperature. And then finally, heat stroke, where your body temperature can get up to 104. Not only do you have the cramps and the nausea and the vomiting, you may also start to have mental health disturbances at this point as well, mental status changing, seizures, coma. That is certainly a life-threatening emergency at that point.
And this is something that's happening because the body, as it warms, is sort of sending blood to the surface to cool.
To cool, so you lose your blood pressure that way, but then not only do you lose your blood pressure that way, you're losing electrolytes. So now your blood pressure is going down, you have low blood volume, and you have electrolyte disturbances, all that can lead to the cramping, the nausea, and the mental status changes.
And that's because those organs are a little bit blood deprived at that point.
So they're not getting perfused with blood as much as they would normally. And as a result, they're not getting oxygen into those areas. And when that happens, our blood cells tend to die.
Right. And I want to talk about that, too, because I've just been recently learning about, you know, when you talk about temperatures that are 107 and higher, what is happening at the cellular level?
Yeah, so that's actually when we start losing our electrolytes. The cells start involuting and dying. They become atrophic. And so if they're not able to do what they need to do, you're not absorbing water, you're not sending that to the rest of the bloodstream. And as a result, your blood pressure drops. You're not getting the blood flow to your brain, your heart, your lungs, and your kidneys, which are the vital organs.
Are these accumulating impacts? For instance, like if you are exposed to heat on a daily basis or infrequently, but still consistently, for things like heart disease, for, you know, cardiovascular impacts.
And it really can be accumulating if you don't take measures in between. So as you're cooling down, you should also be hydrating. If you know that tomorrow you're going to be exposed to these high temperatures, you're going to be outside working, going to a sporting event, then you should be hydrating well ahead of time and getting those electrolytes into your system so that you can be better suited to deal with these issues.
Dehydration can also cause your blood to thicken.
Absolutely. So then you're at increased risk for even blood clots. And this is why folks with heart disease in particular are at increased risk of bad outcomes.
So Dr. Caulfield, body and mind are, of course, connected, as we all know. But the impacts can be different on
Yes.
the brain and on one's mental health state. So what do we know about the impact of heat or living in these repeated heat advisory circumstances?
Right. So individuals that live with mental health challenges are really at high risk. They tend to have a lot of sleep disturbances when the temperatures rise, which causes increased anxiety and depression. What we're finding with very high temperatures is that we have a spike in suicides. People are very agitated. They're very frustrated. They don't have the coping skills to really manage what's happening, both physiologically as well as for their mental health condition. And we also see a spike in violence. So it's very dangerous times for us, and we need to really be very mindful of taking good care of us during these extreme heat situations.
I want to ask you about the sleep disturbances. Is that something that is, for instance, if you don't have an air-conditioned place to sleep, or is that something that you carry home after a day of exposure, even if you're in a cool environment to sleep?
Both, actually. You know, Dr. Asoci and I were talking before the show, and, you know, if you are living with limited means and you're renting, for example, there is no law that states that a landlord has to replace your air conditioning or even offer air conditioning. So that certainly exacerbates someone that is living with mental health challenges if they're living in a rental that does not provide air conditioning. So again, sleep disturbances typically really wreak havoc on the endocrine system, really have hormonal changes, increased cortisol, which again exacerbates an already difficult situation.
And so what are some common mental health issues that can arise during a heat wave?
Increased anxiety, increased depression, thoughts of suicide, like I said, a spike in suicides as a result, homicidal thoughts. People get very, very frustrated, angry. Again, don't have the coping skills, perhaps, to be able to manage their emotions. And so we see an increased spike in violence, rioting, for example. In fact, in jails and prisons, they find an 18% increase in inmates that are become increasingly violent when there is a heat wave.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about excessive heat and its impacts on physical and mental health. You can join the conversation live on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. You are talking about the intersection of, you know, anxiety, depression, and conflict that can be created in extreme heat. And I know that you referenced, you know, some crimes that can be, that can increase. But there really has been some research to show a connection between things like murder, aggravated assault, rape, even terrorist attacks.
Exactly.
In times of extreme heat.
That's right. That's correct. And so, you know, there's so many physiological, environmental issues that we have to think about. It's just not that it's a hot day and we need to drink, you know, a glass of water. It affects us mentally, physically, emotionally when these heat waves are upon us.
And Dr. Joshi, what do we know about what's happening to the brain, whether it's, you know, in physical or chemical that might be contributing to some of those, you know, disruptions in behavior or mood?
So exactly as Dr. Caulfield was mentioning, you know, so as we start to get hot and we lose our blood pressure and we lose our electrolytes, our body is trying to compensate. And one of the ways it compensates is it releases cortisol. Cortisol is a naturally produced steroid. And so you hear all the time that when people are on steroids, they get roid rage and all this stuff. Well, our body is producing more steroids to keep our body functioning. And so, of course, at that time, that can affect our mental acuity and our mental status and our mental illness or mental health in particular. And so the hormonal changes themselves can also affect the brain and how we're thinking.
And Dr. Caulfield, if you know perhaps that you have, you know, either a diagnosed mental illness or perhaps a tendency to some of those issues that you mentioned, like anxiety or depression, and you know that there is, you know, this weather forecast coming, what can people do to prepare or to cope?
Well, definitely stay hydrated. That's key. Stay in a cool environment. Mind your sleep patterns. Make sure that you're getting enough sleep. If you're prone to having sleep disturbances, and particularly with heat issues, you may have to take additional supplements, if you will, to make sure that you're getting a good night's sleep. Also, reach out, get additional support. If you haven't been seeing a therapist, it's time to really see somebody that can help you navigate these difficult times. Perhaps you need a change in your medication. Perhaps you need to get on some medication if you haven't.
I was going to ask about that. I mean, if people are taking medications, should they be thinking about increasing the dosage or changing the dosage?
That might be a possibility, absolutely, because, again, we want people to be stable. We want them to manage their mental health condition and not have these very devastating effects that can occur if they aren't managing it well.
And I guess they should definitely discuss that with their provider first, though, because one of the issues that we get into with the heat, of course, is when you lose body fluids and you get dehydrated, the levels of the medications may start to increase a little bit, too, which can in itself cause side effects that are concerning. So as we think about heat and, yeah, maybe we need to adjust medications, that needs to be done in coordination with a healthcare provider.
Most definitely.
Are there other medications aside from, you know, psychiatric or mental health related medications that change or could change depending on your exposure to sun or heat?
Well, yeah, certainly a lot of cardiac medications have very similar issues that we're talking about here with the medications for mental illness. And so there's some blood pressure medicines that you may want to adjust the dose if somebody's going to be outside for an extended period of time and maybe challenging their systems with low blood pressure to begin with. Diabetic medications, same kind of story. As we get dehydrated, our blood sugar levels may actually go up or go down depending on what activity you're doing. And again, the levels of blood of diabetic medications may need to be adjusted. There are medications out there that do interact with the heat and the sun in particular. So they're antifungals, certain antibiotics that if you're taking and you're exposed to the sun, it can have some effects on your skin as well. And so those are things to keep in mind, too.
So Dr. Joshi, Mayor Deegan last week announced the city's 2024 cooling center plan. This is an initiative that is new with this administration. Explain to us what the cooling center, what's the idea? What's the animating idea behind those?
The big picture here is that we have folks who have to work outside. We have vulnerable populations that may be homeless or don't have air conditioning inside of their homes who are very vulnerable to the heat for all of these reasons that we mentioned. You know, if you look at our community where we have a higher degree of homelessness, a higher degree of issues with unemployment and issues with housing, they're the same areas where we have an increased risk for heart disease and diabetes and mental illness and asthma. And so guess what? Those are the chronic health conditions that are associated with worse outcomes with heat. And so by opening up cooling centers for folks to go to during the hottest times of the day between 11 a.m. and 6 p.m., we allow these folks a chance to cool down, get water, and be in a cool, safe environment. And so this year, which is different than last year's, we have city pools that are available. Remember last year, our city pools were not able to be used. We now have city pools throughout the community, 29 city pools, 16 splash pads that are also available to people who might have to be outdoors during this time that they can cool down, and 21 city libraries, 24 community centers that people can utilize as well for cooling throughout the summer, but in particular on these extreme heat days.
And so when are those triggered? When are those activated?
So I think it's important for people to know that our cooling centers are open all the time. So throughout the summer, you can go to the library during their normal business hours and cool down and get water inside there and refill your water bottle. Same thing with all of our community centers, our city pools, which are open through the summer, and our splash pads. When we activate the cooling center plan is when we reach those extreme heat days, which is when it's 108 to 112 heat index for three straight days, or 113 for even just one day. And the only thing that's different there is we have our JTA buses involved. So if you lack transportation to get to one of these cooling centers, you get on the bus, you let them know I need to go to a cooling center, and they will take you there for free. And so you're able to utilize our transportation system as well when we're activated with the extreme heat day.
So humans are adaptable, Dr. Caulfield, but this impact that we're seeing, these extreme temperatures are coming with a warming planet. What do we know about how quickly adaptable humans can be to these kind of increases and these more severe temperatures?
I think that, for example, if you don't live with a mental health or behavior health care challenge, you're absolutely right. People are resilient when they have these resources in the community that they can take advantage of and do some of this preventive types of activities. I think that, you know, people can move forward in a healthy way. However, vulnerable populations, those that live with mental health, behavior health care challenges, children, for example, as well, older adults, sometimes they are not as able to participate in these preventive measures. Think of our seniors that perhaps have mobility issues, that aren't able to get to the bus stop, they don't have any family members or support system to be able to help them. So we have to think about those target specialized populations that may be more vulnerable. And particularly those that live with mental health challenges, again, additional support is very much recommended as they move through these crises.
How new is our understanding of heat on mental health? Is this a fairly emerging, you know, understanding that we have now?
I think we're having more research as a result of what's happening to our planet. But there always has been research to substantiate what we're talking about today. I think that we are now experiencing temperatures that we perhaps haven't in the past. And so it's becoming more prominent. Prominent conversation, and very grateful that we're having it today.
Dr. Joshi, to that question of, you know, adaptability, human adaptability, do we get the sense that just right at this juncture that climate change is moving quickly, outpacing that ability to adapt?
I mean, it's depending on where you live in the world, right? So in developing countries, third world countries, adaptation is a little bit more difficult, and it's more difficult to be resilient because the entire population is at risk and somewhat vulnerable. Here in the United States, we should be able to stay in front of this as long as we are planning appropriately, like we are here in Jacksonville with our resiliency plan and our sustainability plan and our plan to deal with these issues acutely as they happen. But you also have to be looking at down the road, where do we go? How do we keep our community safe and as cool as possible? Because the rising global temperatures aren't going anywhere. They're continuing to rise, and we have to figure out a way to keep our entire community resilient, which is what we're doing here locally. But if it was more of a global approach, it certainly would make our jobs easier.
I mean, certainly we've been looking at the extreme temperatures here in Florida, especially South Florida, just this last month have been very, very high. You know, 107, 113 feels like, but as to your point, I mean, in Pakistan, it's reached 128 degrees,
right.
You know, and it just is a whole different level of threat.
That's right. And whether or not their governments take it seriously is a different issue. And of course, they have a lot of different political, geopolitical issues going on in different parts of the world, too, that make it very difficult for folks to focus on climate change and managing those vulnerable populations. We here in the United States have the resources, the ability, the intellect, and the infrastructure to make this happen.
Tree canopy is part of that. I know this administration has discussed trying to expand the tree canopy, or I guess protect what is remains of it in future development. How important is that?
Critically important. So tree canopies and looking for where it's important to have the tree canopies can allow us to target funding appropriately. So there are some tools out there, the CDC, the Human Health Resources Index is out there that kind of shows us at a zip code level where we might need to have a cooler environment based on the vulnerability of the community, our build structure, and the local surface temperatures too. So tree canopies are one thing, but our pavement is another thing. You know, we should have more pervious pavement, asphalt, colored asphalt, so that it doesn't allow our surface temperatures to be as hot. There's so many different ways that we can go about this to reduce temperatures locally at the grassroots level. But a tree canopy is a way to start for all of the good reasons that trees provide us for health reasons, but also for cooling as well.
So, Dr. Caulfield, you're talking about vulnerable populations that exist, but for people who are required to work outdoors, for instance, we know that the state can no longer mandate these, you know, water breaks or shade because of some laws that were just passed. But for employers who have people who work outside, what should they be offering proactively to help?
I would definitely recommend that they do provide those breaks. I know that they aren't mandated to do it, like you say, due to the recent law change, to preserve the workforce, to make sure that they're healthy, that they continue to be able to come in and do the job that employers are paying them for. You must mind their health. You must take care of employees, or they're not going to be able to work. They're going to have increased health risk, health issues, which in turn, if you're looking at return on investment, is going to impact the employer's bottom line with absenteeism, increased insurance claims, et cetera. So it's a win-win for everybody if we keep our workers safe.
We've got a call from Douglas in St. Augustine on this topic. Good morning, Douglas. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to comment in terms of being resilient with heat. I'm a self-employed construction worker here in Northeast Florida, and I actually have to budget extra money now because I cannot work as long and as hard during the summer months. I learned the hard way by pushing myself in the heat. I almost gave myself heat stroke a couple of years ago, and it took me several weeks to recover. And I've spoke with several other men, and we're all commenting on, my gosh, it just feels hotter than it used to. And we're really having to scale back and plan ahead our activities. And, you know, this is having an economic impact on my bottom line, but I don't see any other way around it. And I'm one of the lucky ones who has a little surplus. So that's a big change in my life. But every summer I dread it, and I try to save as much money as I can so I can avoid the heat and stay out of it.
Good comment, Douglas. Your thoughts, Dr. Joshi?
Yeah, that's a great comment, and we hear that story all the time. And so one way that you might be able to overcome that is changing your work hours. And so working earlier in the morning or later in the evening and using that middle time of the day to not be outdoors doing the construction could certainly impact your abilities to get work done, still get paid appropriately, but protect yourself from the heat. And, you know, really that's what we would typically recommend to people, along with the hydrating and using loose clothing, light-fitting clothing, that type of thing.
Is there a schedule on which somebody like Douglas can make sure that they're taking proper breaks at certain intervals?
Yeah, I mean, at least during an hour, you should take at least one break. You know, so most of the time when you're talking about people being outside in extreme heat, we want them to hydrate every 15 minutes. And so at least if they had one 15-minute break in an hour, where they can sit and hydrate, that can make a huge impact in their ability to stay hydrated, stay healthy, and not suffer the consequences of extreme heat.
And so how long of a break and how much water?
About 15-minute break once an hour. And then sipping on water throughout the day would be great, but certainly during that 15 minutes that you're out, and it doesn't necessarily have to be 8 ounces at a time, but you just have to keep those electrolytes coming.
But roughly 8 ounces an hour?
8 ounces an hour would be great if you're going to be outdoors all day working.
I want to ask about some other, interventions that people can use and how helpful those are to consider. Sometimes people carry parasols. They're starting to use very often these chilled neck wraps. I'm curious whether sunscreen helps.
I think sunscreen can certainly help in that it prevents those dangerous rays for coming in, so reduces your risk, of course, of skin cancer, but also to reduce your risk of having sunburn and, the painful effects of that. The neck wraps, anything that you can bring with you to make sure that you're going to be safe, you're going to be cool, you're not going to get those hormones imbalanced, you're not going to have that cortisol coming in and causing you to feel more agitated, more angry. It's all so connected on what we can do, both physiologically as well as psychologically, emotionally, to better our health, especially during this heat wave.
Dr. Joshi, talk about that as well, the sunscreen impact. Is that something that can actually deflect the impact of extreme heat, or is it just more of a skin protector?
More of a skin protector than anything. So the clothing is what protects you from the heat. As you know, wearing big, large brimmed hats is something we didn't talk about, but that certainly can protect you from the heat as well. I do love the neck wraps. I think that those are ways to stay cool, and you could use, get them wet, and they work really well for you. You could use them multiple times, and they're not that expensive either. These are other ways for folks to stay cool. But the sunscreen is important so that we can decrease the risk of skin cancer, for sure.
And what are you hearing from our first responders, from our hospitals, about what impact that they are seeing from extreme heat?
Yeah, there's no question that JFRD gets more calls in the summer for heat-related illness, and so do our emergency rooms as well, which is also part of why we decided to put in this cooling center plan in 2023, because we were seeing this uptick in JFRD calls from about mid-May to mid-June, and that was even before it really got hot. So by having these types of programs in place, we hope to reduce those calls.
We had a comment from Kelly on Facebook. She's saying it's important to note that the cooling center plan has not been activated this year. The library downtown has been closed every Sunday. People who live on the streets get bounced for loitering when they try to cool down at other locations.
Okay, so the Sundays, the libraries are normally closed on Sundays, and so are all of our city buildings. And so on Sundays, if we need to activate the plan, which we have not had to do on Sundays so far, then the main library will be open between 11 and 6, and the Legends Center on Soutelle Road will also be open between 11 and 6. But we have not reached those extreme heat days for activating those on Sundays yet.
I gotcha. And so, again, the parameters for that are 113 on any given day.
That's right. Or 108 to 112 for three consecutive days. That would then get us to utilize our heat plan, which would then open those up on Sundays and get the JTA involved.
I just want to dial back to the question of what hospitals and first responders are seeing. Is that something that the city is privy to, at the area hospitals?
This, if we ask for it, we can get that data in terms of what are your numbers in terms of people being admitted into the emergency room for heat-related illnesses.
Yeah, and has that been something that the city's tracking?
We will start tracking that. So it's the kind of thing that, the summer has just really begun. And so over time, over the 3 to 4 month period that we have these extreme temperatures, we'll see what those numbers look like compared to previous years.
We have an email from Andrew. He says, you are talking about human adaptation to extreme heat. What about non-humans? We do know that pets in particular can be vulnerable. And there's certain kind of pets and certain kind of breeds, I guess, that are more so than others with kind of these short snouts.
Pets are obvious. We need to think about our pets, too. So, the time that we spend outdoors with our pets, if you're taking your dog for a walk and you're walking on the pavement, you're wearing your shoes on. Your pet is not, and that's very hot pavement. The pavement is hot. If you walked on the pavement barefoot, you would notice that pretty quickly. You have to be very careful as you're going outside with your animals this time of the year, unless you do it in the early morning or late evening hours. You might want to walk on the grass instead of on the sidewalks. Simple things like that, not leaving your pet in the car on a hot summer's day. If you're going out somewhere where you can't take your pets, leave the pets at home. You have to plan ahead, just like we do with children. You have to plan ahead with your pets as well.
So if people want more information about, the guidelines for these cooling centers, where they're located, where can they find that information?
Yeah, so our City of Jacksonville website, jacksonville.gov/staycooljacks, which is the name of our initiative, will list all of our cooling centers, all of our splash pads, all of our city pools and libraries, and a lot of information about heat-related illnesses, and the Jack's Ready website as well, which is a very good set of information for all kinds of heat-related, not just heat-related emergencies, but all kinds of emergencies here in Jacksonville. Also has great information about the symptoms to look for, how you can manage your own symptoms, and what happens to your medications when they're outside in the heat as well. A lot of good information.
That's jacksready.com?
Jacksready.com. Yeah.
Okay. And we did, Dr. Caulfield, touch on, the fact that people can have some severe mental health impacts, including suicide. We should mention that, if anybody is considering or know somebody that is, at risk of suicide or suicidal thoughts, that there is a 3-digit number that they can call.
Absolutely. That number is 988-988.
And that's a 24/7
hotline. It certainly is.
All
yes.
Right. Well, stay cool out there. Thank you so much for coming on the program today, Dr. Caulfield, Dr. Joshi. Really appreciate it.
Yes. Pleasure. Thank you for having
thank
us.
Thank you.
All right. Up next, from dengue fever to alcohol on airplanes, our own Dr. Joe discusses the latest medical headlines and answers your healthcare questions. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm joined now by our own Dr. Joe Servin of the Saturday WJCT program, What's Health Got to Do With It? He visits us every month for a house call to take to talk about medical news and to take calls and questions. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 904-549-2937. You can also email Dr. Joe at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you don't want us to use your first or last name, that's fine, too. You can just let us know. Dr. Joe, welcome.
And always a pleasure to be here. Happy July.
Happy July. It's so fun to have you back. I can't believe the year is flying by quite so quickly.
Absolutely.
So I'd like to start with a health warning that was issued by the CDC last Tuesday for something called dengue fever. It's not something that we hear too much about in this country. Tell us a little bit about what it is and why the warning.
So dengue fever is a mosquito-borne infection. So you only catch it from mosquitoes that have the infection. The problem is the mosquitoes love hot, humid weather. And normally it's something that's super common in tropical areas. And in the U.S., where the focus has been primarily places like Puerto Rico, and as you start going down towards a more tropical weather. But as you just had a nice segment on heat in general, as the weather gets hotter and more humid, we attract those mosquitoes. And those mosquitoes now have the ability to infect people with this dengue fever. Dengue fever is, it's otherwise known as breakbone fever. The reason is because in people who do get it, the more severe forms of it, it feels as though your bones are breaking. Like you have these terrible joint aches. Wow. Along with the fever and things of that sort.
So excruciating.
It is very unpleasant. Now, it's unusual. What's unusual about this infection is that if you get it for the first time, it tends to be less severe, oddly enough. You may even have it and not even know you had it. Where people get the severe versions is when you're exposed to it the second, third, or fourth time. Huh. That's when your immune system goes awry and it produces all of these symptoms. And that's why it is so essential to kind of be mosquito preventative, if you will.
We are starting to see some cases in the U.S.
They're not. The numbers are now ratcheting up here in the U.S. Enough that the CDC is urging concerns. And mostly, again, it's been Puerto Rico, things of that sort. But they are watching to see how these numbers rise, because in the Americas, so as you start going to the Caribbean, the cruises not far from where we all are, those numbers are way ahead because it's just hot and humid where these mosquitoes are. So this is, again, a mosquito preventative aspect. So the things that we do to try to not get bitten is what's essential that we do now.
And you say it's not something that you can transmit person to person, but if somebody travels abroad or, you know, to a place, a region that has these mosquitoes, they get bit, they can actually transmit it via a mosquito bite if they return here.
Exactly. And so now as people are out cruising to Caribbean or flying or wherever, that is how it works. And again, it's all about the mosquitoes. So remember, they love to feed at dusk and dawn, wear long sleeves, things of that sort.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with our own Dr. Joe Servin. He's here for his monthly house call to talk medical headlines and to answer your healthcare questions if you have them. You can call 904-549-2937, or you can email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I want to ask you about a headline from the Sunday New York Times we discussed a little bit before the show, but it's real interesting. It continues their reporting on the brain impacts of, you know, blast weapons and the exposure, in this case, particularly Navy SEALs who were, you know, not seeing those blasts in combat or direct warfare, but were doing a lot of training with them. Those symptoms that they're experiencing very like PTSD, or what we think of as PTSD.
Yeah. So this is an interesting one. And I think this is one of those stories that we will wait to hear even more as details emerge. But what they found is that they were able to study the brains of people, Navy SEALs in this case, that had committed suicide. And of this small group, but had actual these analyses, every one of them had had some type of blast exposure. So this starts to say that some folks that get this type of exposure, this type of damage from blast exposure, could cause almost psychological, psychiatric effects that lead to depression. It's a correlation. They haven't proven it yet, but it brings out this big question of, like, how do we protect people who are in the front lines with blasts and things of that sort? And it's another element in the story of just traumatic brain injury and how it connects to behavior and mental health in general. And maybe that's part of post-traumatic stress that we will learn, but there's so much more that has yet to be investigated. This was, an important story that they put out there, just to kind of that call to action, if you will.
And this is a military town. Obviously, there's a lot of people that, you know, are active military. There's a lot of retired military. And one thing that was interesting in this report was, you know, the survivors of these suicide victims had said they didn't think that PTSD necessarily fit. They were getting those diagnoses because they were suffering these same kinds of things, terrible insomnia, you know, unexplained rage, disconnected feeling, inability to concentrate. A lot of times those very same symptoms are diagnosed right. as more of a psychological diagnoses of PTSD. And this finding that those may well be, you know, caused by a physical exposure as opposed to a psychological one.
Yeah, that's a really good point. What it tells me is, especially someone who is in my area of medicine and neurology, a lot of times the same organ that you feel that can have damage, that has psychological issues, is the brain. And yes, the symptoms to which these folks had in terms of a blast exposure can certainly look a lot like PTSD. And maybe they do that because there's some mechanism that they both operate under that is so similar. It's just that how they got there were very different. One was through a physical injury, the other one being a psychological exposure. But perhaps it's the same circuits that are involved. And that's what that has to be teased out for us to know it. But yeah, it's fair that we shouldn't just kind of say this is stress. These people deserve being looked at.
It's a very interesting study. I look forward to kind of staying current on that because I know it's still an emerging science. I want to move on to a topic because it's a busy travel weekend coming up.
Yeah.
A lot of people will be flying. For a lot of those people, alcohol will play a part. So, but there's a new study that highlights the risks of drinking and flying. What tell us about that?
So this one was a very interesting study where people that they actually did a randomization to see what people their oxygen levels with alcohol, and clearly when people drank alcohol, it lowered oxygen level. Well, if you go and fly on a plane, that pressurized cabin mimics living at an altitude of approximately anywhere between 7,000 to 8,000 feet, where oxygen is a little lower. So if you add alcohol to that, you are traveling like as though you're a little bit above Denver, Colorado, and your oxygen level is falling with that. You're just kind of putting yourself at a risk, if you will, from a cardiac standpoint or shortness of breath issues, if you're prone to it. And it's just another reminder that maybe alcohol is not the best approach on a plane. I know it's stressful. I just got off of one, and trust me, I'm the first one that wants to get that cocktail. But it's not good for our health in that environment.
It was interesting that the blood saturation, the oxygen saturation levels that they were looking at, because they found that for people who are sleeping, particularly if they were sleeping after drinking and they were on a plane, that their oxygen levels were dropping down to about 85%, which I guess is far below ideal.
Way below ideal. I mean, that puts you in the category of like sleep apnea, where you are just not getting enough oxygen to function well. And those are real impediments to health. And that's why I always, as I look and watch to see how many people order cocktails on planes, I'm all like, no, I want to be the front. Don't do it. Don't do it. It's not a good idea. But yes, it has this profound effect. Everyone thinks that alcohol helps you sleep better. Not really. It actually leads to a more disturbed sleep because of these things. Its other effects on oxygen and things like that.
Interesting. I want to move just to touch at least a little bit on the Surgeon General has issued a couple of really interesting, very different recommendations, one on social media, one about how we should be regarding guns.
Yeah. So he, Dr. Vivek Murthy, the Surgeon General of the U.S., put out a pretty rapid order succession of two big warnings of you. The first one being on social media. That one he urged that there should be a warning label on social media platforms. The idea is that for young children, particularly adolescents and developing children, that it is unhealthy. And on one level, I applaud them completely. We definitely have a social media issue. The question that arises is a warning label the way to do that? Where critics have now come back at them after a few days of this being out has been in the area, well, is all social media bad? And, you know, all the nuances that kind of come to it. Clearly spending too much time with social media, and too much time is now, they've done studies on this, is where you are like at 2, 3, 4, 5 hours a day straight of doing this is going to be problematic for a developing child.
And the guns thing is also kind of a diametric, perhaps opposed or different at least, but another recommendation he's come out with so quickly.
So on the gun issue, he says that we are in a public health crisis, not emergency, and that we need to be looking at how we can best prevent gun injuries, because now in deaths from guns and things of that sort has now become one of the top physical health rationale for the death of children in the U.S. And as a result, that's why he says it's become a public health crisis and has a lot of mandates or suggestions of what needs to be done to shore that up.
Yeah, and increasingly looking at treating gun violence as kind of a health matter more than...
And the truth is, when something goes wrong with guns, death or anything, it does show up in hospitals and healthcare. So there is a point to be made there.
Dr. Joe, thank you so much for being here. You can hear Dr. Joe's program, What's Health Got to Do With It, every Saturday at 4 on WJCT. It's always great to see you.
And always great to see you. Happy 4th.
Yeah, thank you. You too.
Thank you.
Up next, a new theater production with stage appeal for Disney fans.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. When people are hurt through no fault of their own, answering who, what, when, where, why, and how is critical to proving the truth. More at TerrellHogan.com.
Now, I've been waiting to say this every day for the last 11 weeks. The Fort McHenry Channel is fully cleared and the Port of Baltimore is reopened for business.
Crews removed more than 50,000 tons of debris after the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge, what it took to reopen one of the nation's busiest ports. That's on the next On Point.
Today at 11, here on WJCT News 89.9.
In his final few months in office, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador is trying to change the judicial system. He wants all judges elected by popular vote. Critics say it's a power move, and markets have reacted negatively. I'm Marco Werman. President Obrador's rush for judicial reform, next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
For the best music from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, tune in to 89.9 HD3, the WJCT app, or jacksmusic.org. We've got your music on Anthology on 89.9 HD3.
It's the end of another historic term at the Supreme Court, which is releasing a flurry of high-profile rulings this week. Next time on 1A, we look at what the courts considered. We take stock of the decisions made, how they could affect the rule of law, and the stakes for the November election. That's next time on 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. The classic Tarzan of the Apes hits the stage at Players by the Sea in just a week, but this performance has a few tweaks. It's based on the Disney version. Here to tell us about it, I'm joined now by the show's director, Mike Beeman. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for being here. We're also joined by Chris Berry, who portrays Tarzan. Good morning, Chris.
Yes, good morning.
And Abigail Douglas, who plays the iconic Jane. Good morning, Abigail.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for being here. So, Mike, you began casting this show in April. You announced the cast in May. It seems like a very quick pace. Is that typical for Players by the Sea?
I think it is pretty typical. We've got a nice working calendar to get as many dance rehearsals as we needed in, as many movement rehearsals as we needed in, and as many vocal rehearsals as we needed in. So I think it's a pretty average turnaround time for most community theater.
There was a visit that your team made to the Jacksonville Zoo, I understand, as kind of a team building exercise. So tell me a little bit about why the zoo? What was the thinking there?
Well, so many of the actors in the show are portraying apes, gorillas, primates of various sizes. And so we went and studied the way that the apes moved. We watched how they interacted with one another. We watched the baby apes and how they interacted with their parents. We got to quiz the folks who worked at the zoo and grill them for information about what do they do when they're angry? What do they do when they're happy? How do they show affection? And incorporate that into the storytelling that we're doing live on stage at Players by the Sea.
Now, Abigail, you don't portray an ape. You portray one of the humans in this cast. But
yes.
What did you learn from that adventure at the zoo?
I unfortunately was not there at the zoo, but I did watch a lot of the videos, a lot of the pictures, and I asked my friends how it was. And I thought it was so interesting to see everyone talk about how they could see how apes move when there aren't like people there at the zoo, and they could see like their true forms. And it was like so interesting to see everyone incorporate that onto stage. Now I'm seeing everyone become truly apes, and it's so cool to watch from the audience.
You are a local, you're from Jacksonville originally?
Yes, I am.
Douglas Anderson student?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you've been performing since you were 9?
Yeah, I've been performing for a very long time. I grew up dancing, and then I decided to do theater at an educational theater at Players by the Sea when I was little. And then ever since, I've just continued to do theater, and now I go to college for it.
And so how does musical theater fit into all over, you know, theater for you? Is that your preference?
Yeah, I do. I've done so many shows growing up. Like, I couldn't even tell you how many. And I love doing it. It's my passion. I want to do it for the rest of my life. And it just feels like it makes me a better human to be a theater kid. I just love it.
Chris Berry, I want to ask you about the job of Tarzan, because it seems like it's probably a pretty physically challenging role.
It is. It is a very physically demanding role.
What do you have to do? Are you swinging on vines and wearing a loincloth? I mean, what are the parameters here?
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of acrobatics. There's monkey bars. There's a lot of heights. I'm jumping off of, rolling, tumbling. Yeah, so it's also kind of also embodying the ape physique as well. So a lot of just walking on my knuckles and just trying to portray the Tarzan that everyone knows and loves.
Is that something that you had to prepare for, or you just been kind of learning as you go?
Oh, definitely learning as I go. It's just a lot of trial and error too, like watching a lot of videos on how apes move, how they communicate. Trying to emulate some of that as well while staying true to the source material.
Mike, this is your directing debut at Players by the Sea, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
So what is it about this show? Was this something that you selected? Was it something that the theater selected? And how do you, you know, how do you put yourself and your influence in a show like this that's kind of well known to Disney fans?
I started, I was asked if I would want to direct the show. So they had already selected the show and then they were looking for a director. And I started by going right back to the source material and reading the original text. And
you mean the book?
The book.
Yeah.
Yeah. The book that was written over 100 years ago, and gleaning what I could from that original text. And then watched, of course, the Disney film, which is vastly different than the original text. And then was like, okay, how do we mix these two? So we're not going completely Disney, but keeping it real for the Disney fans. And so all the folks who love all those great tunes and those great characters are going to be happy, but there is enough intrigue for the adults as well.
So Abigail, the music in this, we should say, is written by Phil Collins, who's mm-hmm. A man behind a lot of 1980s anthems and a couple of sappy love songs and some other, you know, popular songs. What is it like singing his music?
Oh my God. It is one very hard because it's all kind of like poppy rock and I'm not used to that. I usually sing like very contemporary musical theater songs, but it is so fun to sing his music because they're just they're challenging and they're exciting. And I love watching everyone sing the songs like, You'll Be in My Heart. That sounds beautiful. Or Two Worlds. Ugh, they all sound so amazing. His music is fabulous.
So what is your favorite moment of this show, Chris?
Oh, man. I think one of my favorite moments is the moment that Tarzan sees Jane for the very first time, because up until this point, he's been living his entire life thinking he's something and then sees something that completely changes his world and he has to know more about it.
Well, the show starts July 12th. It runs through July 28th. Thank you all so much for being here. Have a great performance. Break a leg.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's our program. Join us tomorrow when we explore what information homeowners are required to disclose when they put their home up for sale. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.